and this is your call. 5 years after the financial crisis of 2008, we frequently hear that the housing market is rebounding, with home sales increasing and the number of foreclosures decreasing. But what does this so-called recovery mean for the 10 million people who've lost their homes over the past 6 years? That's 10 million people. And how have banks' lending practices changed? In her new book, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home, Laura Gottesdiener says Black families have lost more than half of their median wealth since the economic crisis began. And overall, economists predict that it could take 20 years to recover the amount of money lost between 2005 and 2010 in the housing market alone. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the foreclosure crisis. How are families coping with this? How are they fighting back? And what are we currently facing? Laura Gottesdiener is a journalist and social justice activist. She's an associate editor for Waging Nonviolence. She lived and worked in the People's Kitchen during the occupation of Zuccotti Park in Manhattan. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So I was kind of surprised when I read the 10 million number, because we don't see that number very much in the media when there are stories about foreclosures. First of all, how did you come up with that number, that 10 million people lost their homes in the last 6 years?
You know, I was pretty surprised by that number, too, as it started to just increasingly jump off the page as I was researching and doing these calculations. And I think you're right, you're spot on to say we haven't heard that number. And we haven't heard that number because there's no government agency at any level whose responsibility it has been to track the number of people who have been evicted throughout this historic housing crisis. That to me itself, you know, the fact that this number wasn't readily available was quite shocking. But as I started to run the numbers and access the, you know, private data from RealtyTrack and other CoreLogic and other industry providers, and then started to run that against what the policy experts were saying, and this really quite conservative estimate of 10 million jumped off, I was floored. Mm. You know, and to put it in perspective, it's as if every single man, woman, and child in the state of Michigan had been up and evicted from their homes in the last 6 years.
Wow. What areas of the country were hit the hardest?
We were seeing, you know, it came in waves. So, for example, Michigan got hit really early, really hard. Then we saw, you know, the Pacific Southwest get hit really hard. So Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico. Florida was always hit very hard throughout the crisis. We also had states like New Jersey and Rhode Island hit really hard. California has had, quantitatively, the most foreclosures, partially because the state is so big, partially because Hispanics have been hit very hard by the crisis, disproportionately hard, and there's a large number of Latinos living in California. Mm.
And is there any way to figure out why most of these people lost their homes?
These 10 million people lost their homes between approximately 4.5 and 5 million bank-pursued foreclosures. So right now I'm just looking at the ones that were driven by bank-pursued foreclosures, not necessarily local government tax foreclosures. So the question of why, it's a complicated question. Why, in part because many people defaulted on their mortgage, but that's related obviously to the much larger predatory lending crisis in which millions upon millions of people were sold loans that were unpayable and really could never have been paid back. And then, of course, the market crashed. And so, millions of people found that they owed more on their house than their house was worth. And that's a situation of being underwater on your mortgage. And that, too, it's quite clear, pushes people into default.
And now your book is called A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. And you focus on four Black families, Bertha Garrett in Detroit, Martha Biggs in Chicago, Griggs Wimbley in North Carolina, and Michael Hutchins in Tennessee. Why did you decide to focus on Black families?
It's a great question. I get it a lot, particularly because I'm a white journalist. There's two reasons, and people always think it's the first. The former is that African American families were disproportionately affected by this crisis. African Americans have been twice as likely to lose their homes over the last 6 years compared to white families, and they've been three times more likely to be sold predatory loans. Mm. So particularly in higher income brackets, if you compare an African American family with high credit, good credit score, and a white family with a good credit score, you saw that the African-American family was three times more likely to be sold the type of, you know, industry calls it subprime loan that was much more likely to explode as the crisis set in. That actually, you know, that's important. I think it's important to understand the disparate and disproportionate effects and how race still impacts our economy and our daily lives. But that's not actually why I decided to focus on these four families in this community. And instead, it was because as I traveled the country, I was really looking to find communities and community-based organizations that were doing a very good job to combat the displacement, figuring out ways to keep people in their homes, to keep communities together, to keep the local economy from spiraling. And I found that in many African-American communities, groups were particularly well-equipped to handle the crisis and were proposing very visionary solutions of how we could avoid a crisis in the future. And I felt that it was quite important for everybody of all races to see and understand how these communities were organizing against this crisis.
Can you just give us a brief 101 on predatory loans? Because we've done a lot of shows about this. We've talked about liar's loans, about people given AAA ratings when they shouldn't have received a loan in the first place, about how the lender would lie about the person's salary. Can you just go over that again?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I want to put it as well in a historical context. I think that's been missing largely from the conversation. And so just briefly, you know, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, adjustable rate mortgages, they were called ARMs, which were in the category of subprime loans or predatory loans, exploded. It exploded into this trillion-dollar market. And the way adjustable rate mortgages work is that rather than having a fixed rate mortgage, you know, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, which has for a long time been the bedrock of our economy or our mortgage economy, instead, the interest rate would be low for a number of years and then would increase, and often quite dramatically. So we could see it increase from 3 or 4% to maybe 10% or 15% or up to 20%. These are called ballooning mortgages. And they're ballooning because you start low and then obviously your principal balloons and your payments balloon. And what many people didn't understand and what it was very complicated to understand was the fact that in many of these loans, they were interest-only loans, or in the sense that you believed you were paying down your principal. You were told often, you know, to your face you were paying down your principal, but what you were really only doing was paying down a portion of your interest. So actually, families would be paying each month, and yet the amount they owed ultimately on that loan was only increasing over time. And that was a situation that, you know, hundreds of the families that I spoke to were experiencing. To turn briefly, you know, just for a minute, to how this relates to the historical context, particularly in the African-American community, what we saw was that for most of the 20th century, the federal government, the Federal Housing Administration, had a policy of redlining minority communities. So any community in which people of color predominantly lived, the federal government wouldn't loan or guarantee any lending for mortgages. The result of that, obviously, was that these communities were starved of credit, starved of mortgages, very difficult to achieve home ownership. You saw a lot of overcrowding. You saw a lot of exploitative conditions. That ended as a result of, you know, massive grassroots organizing followed by, you know, federal legislation, the Fair Housing Act in 1968, the Fair Lending Act in 77, Community Reinvestment Act. But what was most insidious about this current crisis, the one that, you know, began in the late, you know, the bubble that began in the late 90s all the way through the 2000s and then obviously burst in 2007, 2008, was that many of the major mortgage players and banks recognized that this nation's history of racial discrimination provided them an opportunity to sell very toxic, very predatory loans to people who had been systematically excluded from the market for most of the 20th century. And that's why we are seeing incredibly high rates of foreclosure in these African-American communities, because they were targeted for these predatory loans, knowing that people had really never had access to this credit and needed it.
And you write that even though these laws were passed in 68 and 77, the banks still discriminated against people on the basis of race. And you also write about a loan officer testifying that Wells Fargo basically put bounties on the heads of people of color by paying cash incentives to loan officers to push those in neighborhoods of color. But what's so interesting about this is when you hear it in the media or just in conversations, it's very simplified. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, well, why would you sign a 90-page document or however long they are without bringing in a lawyer or really reading it over detail by detail to make sure that you're not being taken advantage of?
You know, I think that we in the media, as journalists and in the broader public, always have a tendency to blame consumers and to blame just essentially ourselves because we're not used to holding authorities culpable. Particularly today, I think, is a day where we can start to say it's time to hold authorities culpable, to shut down the federal government. So, I've heard a lot, that this was a problem of financial literacy, that people didn't understand what they were signing. That's largely true, that people didn't understand what they were signing, in part because these documents, which millions upon millions of people purchase, it's the primary way we drive housing in the United States, were written to be entirely illegible, were written to be entirely ununderstandable. And we've had attorney generals of various states. The attorney general of California came out and said, frankly, I'm a lawyer, obviously, and I don't know that I understand my mortgage. So what I think is important to say at this moment is, and this is something that Elizabeth Warren said a number of years ago, is there's no reason that we should be treating housing and mortgages differently. If we want to call it a commodity, we should treat it like other commodities, and we should regulate it like other commodities. And if we were to do so, if we compared it to toasters, as Elizabeth Warren did a number of years ago, if millions upon millions of toasters started exploding all around the country and catching fire and burning houses down and displacing families, we wouldn't say, well, what are these stupid people that didn't read the fine print on their toasters? We'd say, what company, in God's name, what company has sold the American people all of these exploding toasters? And this is terrible, and those people should go to jail for the damage they've done.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a good analogy, because you do hear that often, that people didn't take responsibility when they signed such a massive document. We're speaking today with Laura Gottesdiener. She's a journalist and social justice activist. She's out with a new book called A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. And she has done, I guess we can call it meticulous research, because as she said, the government doesn't keep track of how many people have been foreclosed. And based on her research, 10 million people have lost their homes in the past 6 years. And we'd love to hear from you if you've been affected by the foreclosure crisis. Tell us your story and how are you coping? And if you're involved with communities that are fighting back, Laura has a number of stories of families fighting back to save their homes, and we'll talk about those. And then if you work in real estate or banking, we'd love to hear from you. How did this happen? Where are we today? And what sort of protections are in place so this doesn't happen again, if any? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Does this 10 million number surprise you? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Laura, why is it that no federal agency keeps track of foreclosed homes, considering the fact that this is so massive?
I want to be clear and say, the U.S. Postal Service, before it was hit very, very hard by cuts and austerity measures and union busting up, attempts, does keep track and keep a database of vacant properties. It's not quite the same as bank foreclosed homes, but it's somewhat related. So that does exist. What I was particularly struck by was that no government agency tracks the number of people, and the government is obviously supposed to represent the people who have been affected by this crisis, and particularly people who have been displaced as a result of this crisis. And, to me, it's in part a symptom of the fact that the government was utterly unprepared for this crisis and to deal with it. And we've seen that in the repeated failure of the administration's attempts to provide aid to homeowners. In part, I also want to say that I think it's symptomatic of a broader way we've documented and responded to this crisis. And to to draw a comparison, for example, the U.S. Treasury Department has been very good at documenting the amount of household wealth lost by, you know, families across the country. You know, according to the latest numbers, it's around $19.2 trillion. So lots of, billion dollars. So lots and lots of household wealth lost. What no government agency has decided to do is track the number of people who have lost their homes. And to me, that really shows we've been measuring this crisis in stock values, in interest rates, in wealth lost. We haven't been measuring it in any comprehensive way in the human effects. Mm. And when I say human effects, I don't mean simply numbers of people. I also mean rising rates of depression, rising rates of suicide, of hospital visits, of missed school days, of the number of children whose grades have slipped as a result of them being shuttled from house to house. We have all this data in different corners of the policy world, how being homeless, for example, affects a student's school performance. Yet we didn't decide that it was one of our national priorities to pull it together and to really take a look at what is the human and community level impact of this crisis been. So that, you know, seeing that gap in our reporting was why I began to write this book.
Well, let's take a few callers before we go to break. Let's hear from John in Santa Cruz. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hey, I want to thank you guys for bringing this topic up to the public, because I feel like the press in general does a real bad job of maintaining a focus on this issue. I feel like at this point, the banking industry, among many others, has reached a sort of a mob morality level where they don't have any morals and they don't care. And there should be some accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Should be some...
John, I understand that you had to deal with a foreclosure. Is that right?
Yes, I lost my house in 08.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how it happened?
Well, I'm a due diligence consultant that does consulting for banks, and so my business evaporated.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't able to make my house payment. And at that time, there was no glimmer of any kind of support or ability to fight back. So basically, the sheriff came and took my house.
Mm. And how did that affect you? Because Laura was just talking about the stories we don't hear about just the depression, the emotional issues.
Well, I spent about 3 years sleeping on couches. I'm lucky to have a great family, but was unable. My business was impaired because of the banking problem also, so I wasn't able to recover any income for all the 3 years.
And since you have a close connection to banks, John, how do you think they should be held accountable?
Well, the one issue that doesn't get talked about very much is the real root of the corruption is the appraisal process.
Mm.
The way that the misinformation gets passed along is that the appraisal process is so corrupt because everybody wants to have their appraisal come out the way they need it, and there's no real audit for that process.
Well, thank you so much for calling, John. Laura, what are your thoughts on that, the appraisal process?
Well, John, first I just want to say, you know, thank you for calling and sharing that. I know it can be very difficult to talk about foreclosure and eviction, and I'm really sorry that you lost your home in 08. I think John's completely right that we need to see some accountability. You know, in 2008, you know, when John lost his home, we had all of the mainstream press, really, and all of the banking industry and much of the government crying that, you know, principal reduction, widespread principal reduction, a widespread government effort to reduce the amount people owed on their mortgages in order to keep people from defaulting, would create a situation of moral hazard. And moral hazard essentially means, well, if you see your neighbor getting something that you're not going to get, well, then maybe I'll go into default too so I can get this principal reduction. And people were saying that it would essentially erode the foundations of this country. Yet, we didn't take into consideration at all, really, the idea that not having accountability for the banks that had gotten us into this mess, not only for the corruption of the appraisal process, which I completely agree with John, was a very corrupt process in which the banks would hire their own appraisers. So really it was the left hand was setting the right hand up for success and everybody was in on the game. But the whole securitization process, really, in which no bank, no mortgage company would be ultimately have their bottom line affected if we as American people, as homeowners, didn't pay back these loans. That itself was a very corrupt process because the incentives were perverse. So we didn't see any meaningful effort on the part of the federal government, on the Department of Justice, to really hold these banks criminally responsible. And that's created a situation of moral hazard where we know, and it's well documented, that banks and the rating agencies such as S&P are getting into the same game that they were in the late 90s and early 2000s. And frankly, they have no incentive not to, because we have not demonstrated as a nation that we're willing to hold them accountable.
Well, can you elaborate on that a bit? Because I just found this op-ed in the New York Times, actually an editorial, Deceptive Practices in Foreclosures.
Yep.
And I'll talk about this in a minute, because there's a lawsuit that was just filed by the Attorney General of Illinois. Mm-hmm. But the end of this piece says, the failure of federal policy to ensure adequate mortgage relief to borrowers, even as the banks were bailed out, remains an injustice and a drag on the economy. Foreclosure abuses add inexcusable insult to injury. So what has the Obama administration done on this issue?
Attached to TARP, which was, you know, the legislation that allowed for the bailout, that was signed actually into law on October 3rd, 2008, so we're coming up in 2 days on the five-year anniversary, was a very small amount of money allocated to homeowner relief, and it was called HAMP. HAMP was, and Obama made some very celebratory announcements, expected to help millions of homeowners, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 million homeowners. It was widely considered and still is considered an epic failure. In fact, it was such a failure that, you know, a few months before Obama's reelection, before the election, which he did win, the New York Times ran a news analysis, not even an op-ed, a news analysis saying, essentially asking the question, was the administration's response to this foreclosure crisis on the part of just actual people so bad and such an epic failure that he will not be elected, that it'll cost him the election? And we know ultimately that wasn't true. Obviously, you know, Mitt Romney did not win, and I do not contend he would have done any better job. But what we've seen is that the administration has had a very difficult time for some reason allocating money to homeowners in need. And there's really no good excuse for that when we were able to sign off more or less blank checks to the banks overnight. I don't understand why it's been so difficult. I've never received a good reaction or excuse when I've asked that question. And I'm still really waiting to understand why it was so hard.
So what do they say to you? And have you talked to any politicians who actually are doing something to help people who've lost their homes?
I've talked to politicians and government officials. I've looked into particularly the hardest hit fund. And what I've seen by and large has been that the government at all levels has dragged their feet to allocate money to homeowners. And I want to be clear, I don't think even if we'd allocated a lot of money to principal reduction for homeowners, that would have been sufficient in any way. You know, in 2010, the vast majority of Americans who polled supported a moratorium. And what a moratorium means is there are no more foreclosures. And there's, you know, a temporary suspension on foreclosures during the Great Depression.
And Laura, sorry to cut you off. Just hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Laura Gottesdiener. She's author of A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. She's a journalist and social justice activist. And she's found that 10 million people have lost their homes in the past 5 years. And we'll talk after the break about private equity firms that are buying up these homes. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join today's conversation, if you have a perspective that you haven't yet heard in today's discussion, please get in touch by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about restorative justice programs in schools. It's a way to resolve conflict and decrease suspension, specifically focusing on kids that come from violent backgrounds or have trouble with their families and don't know how to deal with some of these emotions at school, rather than suspending them and doing a no-tolerance policy. A lot of schools are turning to restorative justice. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. And then on Thursday, just a day before the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival starts in San Francisco, we will talk about political protest music. We'll talk about its legacy and where it's alive today. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the foreclosure crisis. We always hear about the housing market rebounding. Home sales are increasing, the number of foreclosures decreasing. But the fact is, according to today's guest, Laura Gottesdiener, a social justice activist, or Diener, sorry, and journalist, she's found that 10 million people have lost their homes in the past 6 years. And she writes about this in her new book, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've been hit by the foreclosure crisis, we'd love to hear your story. How are you coping? If you're involved in an organization that is helping families fight back, literally taking on authorities when they come to the house and break down the door. This is happening across the country. And then if you work in banking or real estate, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Laura, before the break, you were talking about these foreclosure moratoriums, and this got a lot of momentum last year. First of all, what is a foreclosure moratorium, and where did they take place, and are they still in effect anywhere?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, I was saying that, you know, we talk a lot about principal reduction, essentially, just reducing the amount people owe. But, you know, in 2010, the majority of Americans polled supported the idea of simply stopping evictions, simply putting a temporary hold on foreclosures and evictions. And we saw that the historical precedent for that is that during the Great Depression, we saw 26 states enact foreclosure moratoriums for both, sometimes only homes and sometimes for both homes and farms. So how it works is it's usually not national. It's often, at least historically, done state by state. And essentially what it says is we're in the middle of a national crisis, and to continue throwing people out of their homes would worsen that crisis. And that's exactly what we've seen. We've seen the dislocation and displacement of people coupled with the increasing number of vacant properties really continuously worsen the economic crisis. It could have been significantly less severe for everyday people. And so a foreclosure moratorium, the goal of that would be to stop that, to essentially stop a downward spiral. We didn't see any states enact foreclosure moratoriums this time around, and I think that's going to be, in hindsight, one of the major failures of our government.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show. Hello, Linda. Linda, sorry, but you can call us back and we'll put you on. Let's go to Rich in Ben Lomond. Hi, Rich.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm with a school of thought that believes that the problem is fractional banking. That means that banks can loan you money they don't have. Let me give you an example. Suppose you want to buy a house for $200,000 and you've saved up $25,000 and you go to a bank for a loan. Well, they'll say, well, give us 10% down and fees and we can loan you the money. And according to the rules that they've written, they can loan you that money by honoring checks, honoring your checks, because money is backed up by nothing. And for example, that's why an $11,000 house now costs $500,000. And Ron Paul, for example, has talked about this. He suggests going back to the gold standard because, for example, if you say a house, a $25,000 house costs $500,000, and you're on the gold standard, technically that money wouldn't be available. So what I'm talking about is keeping the prices down so people can afford them. And in economics, the term for that is inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to. That's
all right.
That's my take.
Thank you, Rich. What are your thoughts, Laura?
You know, I think that what Rich is talking about in terms of how the banks are over-leveraged, how they don't hold on to enough money, or certainly the amount of money that they're lending out, And as a result of that, and as a result of the appraisal system, you know, that our previous caller, John, was talking about earlier, we've had significant inflation of housing prices doubling over decades, you know, in a way that obviously doesn't reflect any real changes in the use value of houses. Yes, houses have gotten larger, but they certainly haven't, you know, gotten larger with the same rate at which they've gotten significantly more expensive. I want to say, you know, quickly that I think there could be hundreds of different schools of thought of what caused this current crisis, and everyone's of a slightly different opinion. My opinion is really that there is no one explanation, and yet that it's simply a more fundamental root cause. And the more fundamental root cause is I really believe that the for-profit housing system in its entirety is to blame. And when I say that, I mean that the idea that we've swung so far ideologically in valuing homes for their future speculative monetary value rather than their current use value as a place in which people would live is ultimately ideologically the root of the crisis. And then we can start talking about inflation as a symptom of that, a corrupt appraisal system as a symptom of that. So there's lots of symptoms, but root cause, I believe that it's ultimately, and you know, the organizers that I was following and documenting in the book ultimately believe that the problem is we have really bad land relations in this country, in which very few people hold a lot of the land, many people do not hold any of the land, and by valuing land as a commodity rather than a natural resource, rather than a fundamental right and thing people need to live on, we end up with a perverse incentive, an economy with perverse incentives, and we end up in a situation where we have far, far, far more millions of vacant houses than the number of people who each night don't have a place to sleep.
Well, in addition to the 10 million number you found, again, 10 million people have lost their homes in the past 6 years. The other thing that doesn't really get much attention when we talk about foreclosures is these private equity firms that are buying up these homes. And you write that, like, for example, the Blackstone Group, one of the largest private equity companies in the world, is now buying huge tracts of lands with foreclosed homes, spending billions of dollars in the last 2 years buying up hundreds of thousands of foreclosed homes. Can you tell us more about this, and why doesn't this get more attention?
Yeah, I think this is a very important topic, and it's related to what I was saying earlier about right now, future speculative values of homes actually make getting into the market of buying up foreclosed properties a really good business. And I'll explain, it's pretty basic economics in the sense that the housing market is still depressed, even though we've seen rebounds in certain parts of the country. And so right now you can buy a home for half the value that you think it may be worth in 10 years because we saw, you know, the housing market crash so spectacularly. As a result, that's obviously gotten the attention of private equity firms and hedge funds, companies like the Blackstone Group, which you mentioned, which is one of the largest players in this game, but certainly not the only one. And so they're investing billions of dollars. Blackstone, for example, has invested $4.5 billion in buying up tens of thousands of these foreclosed properties and sometimes holding on to them and sometimes renovating them and using them to rent out. But ultimately, what we're really seeing, and it's important to put it again in the racial and community context, is we're seeing financial companies going into neighborhoods, particularly communities of color, buying up massive tracts of the land and then either land banking them or turning everybody who, many of which who had already been forced out of their home through foreclosure recently, into renters. And again, to talk about the issue of bad land relations, those are bad land relations in which then you have a whole community who has very little say over what happens in their own community and in their place where they live because they don't own the apartment buildings and they don't own the land underneath it because the Blackstone Group owns the entire community.
And they're buying these homes with cash.
In cash, yes. I mean, when I say in cash, it means, you know, there's no financing required. So of course, it actually means there's wire transfers rather than trucks, you know, filled with cash idling outside. But what it means to buy something in cash is, again, to leverage the fact that the Blackstone Group has trillions of dollars in equity, and an average family may have $50,000 in the bank. So if you want to go buy a $250,000 house, you know, a family would need to take out a loan. Blackstone Group can simply wire the money immediately. And so I was speaking recently to a realtor out in in inner city Los Angeles, and he was saying, it has been 2 years, and I have been actively trying to sell a house to a middle-income African-American family, but in 2 years, I have not been able to because the banks and these hedge funds and these private equity firms keep putting in cash offers, and I can't get any of my families to compete with cash. They have no ability to compete with cash.
We're speaking with Laura Gottesdiener. She's a journalist and social justice activist, author of A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. And she has found that 10 million people have lost their homes over the past 6 years. And we've got about 15 minutes left. So if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have personal experiences with foreclosures, if you work with community groups that try to help people keep their homes, if you work in real estate or in the banking industry, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Kim in Santa Cruz. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just calling because I agree with your panelists or your guests about this attacking the whole fabric of America. I work in new home sales and have since the late 90s during the dot-comer boom. People were worth more on paper than they actually had. And through 2003, which countrywide appeared on the scene, we had our regular lender and we had our B-paper lender. And the gentleman came in. He could not qualify. He only made $40,000 a year. He'd only been in the country for 6 months. And neither one of our lenders could approve him. Then he came back with lender in tow, said, I have a lender approval. We could not figure out how he was doing this. We thought it was, you know, as professionals, we thought it was just some equation that the lenders had pulled, and we would never figure out. But it is affecting the fabric of America, and a lot of the home buyers were told something by the lender, and then when they get to the closing table, was something completely different.
Well, thank you for calling in. What are you seeing out there in home sales? And what are your thoughts, since you work in this industry, what are your thoughts about the foreclosure crisis? Kim, are you still with us?
I don't work in the industry anymore because my livelihood is completely gone in new home sales, even though I do work for a green builder. Hmm. They are now concentrating on custom homes. But the thing is that it's affected everybody, but, you know, everyone, like you said, we had preferred lenders, and then also the banks, they followed suit. They followed, Wells Fargo was pretty honest until 2003, and then they all followed Countrywide's lead, from Bank of America to Wells Fargo to the government agencies, Acorn.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. You know, and since you brought up Countrywide, you reminded me of this segment that ran on 60 Minutes. I think it was 2 years ago. And a former Countrywide whistleblower, Ellen Foster, she was an executive VP in charge of fraud investigations at Countrywide, told 60 Minutes that mortgage fraud was a common occurrence at the firm. She said she faced illegal retaliation for filing reports investigating the fraud. And she said she also went to the federal government, but no one did anything. Why is that, Laura? I mean, a lot of people have spoken out who worked on the inside.
A lot of people have spoken out. I was reminded when you were recounting that 60 Minutes episode of the other one in which everybody was Linda Green during the robo-signing scandal. I'm not sure if any of the listeners caught that, but a similar case of fraud, the robo-signing scandal, which we refer to a lot, but I think have forgotten what it meant. And what it meant and what it entailed was just massive forgery on an unprecedented scale. I've never heard of such a large-scale forgery in the history of this country, in which bank employees were signing off on the foreclosure affidavit, essentially saying, I'm an employee, I have read this document, I can see that this homeowner has defaulted on their loan, has not paid their loan. I assure you that I've read it and have checked all the facts and all of this information is correct, and I will now sign my name to say that I have done all of these things. Well, not only did nobody read the documents, but in fact there were dozens, if not hundreds, of employees signing the same name, Linda Green, simply because the name was shorter. And they were on such pressure to sign these documents. I'm saying such pressure to sign the documents that obviously not only did they not read it, but that they chose to sign a different name other than their own because simply it was shorter. I mean, my last name is Gottesdiener, and I can tell you it takes about 45 seconds to sign my name. So if I were under pressure to sign 10,000 foreclosure affidavits a day, too, I might also become Linda Green. But, you know, I think what you're asking, and I wanted to use that example because we talk about fraud, and we say, why has there not been any response to fraud? We sometimes forget to say what that fraud was. Mm. And I really think that one of the reasons that we have not seen more accountability and we have not seen more outrage is that we forget to talk about the crimes that are being committed. Mm. That is, that robo-signing scandal was tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of forged documents every single day, which were used to force people out of their homes, whether they had actually defaulted or had not actually defaulted. And all of the different accounts of forgery and fraud that have occurred in the last decade are just as audacious and just as atrocious. And one of the reasons that we don't see more action is that we, as members of the press and sometimes the financial press, kind of talk around the issues. That's lying. Mm. So in my mind, that's banks lying to all of us that they have not done their work, they have not dotted their I's or crossed their T's or even signed their names. And that's why we're in that this mess.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Kim. And we've got full lines, so let's try to go through as many callers as we can. And I also want to make sure we talk about how people are fighting back. So let's go next to Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. In 2003, I purchased a home in Santa Cruz. I put 20% down. I had a good income. I was self-employed. But my mortgage broker, they falsified my records to increase their commission. The bank did a drive-by appraisal. I never should have gotten a loan on the place. I learned when I went to court how many documents they had forged. They forged my signature on my mortgage document, and I could not get a copy of it. And then this went on. I wanted to sell it at a short sale. They wouldn't let me. It dangled, hang around until 2009, and then they foreclosed. And my suggestion, and I think this is a Wall Street problem. I agree with Laura. It's complicated. It's Wall Street and Main Street. My local realtor lied. The mortgage broker, the home inspection company. There's so much greed here that all of this happened, and there's so much of it. There's too many places to, you know, tack down. But I think we need changes in all those areas. Mm-hmm. These are people in my community of Santa Cruz that did this. They lied to make more money for themselves.
Well, and Laura, Linda, how were you able to find this out? Because what's so hard about this is it's hard to follow the paper trail. A lot of people don't even know who owns their mortgage. So how did you figure this out?
Well, because I was in court and it went on for so long. My mortgage was, I did start with Countrywide. It was handed down, I think, to four or five mortgage handlers. And the company that ultimately ended with the piece of paper, I didn't even know who they were until I found out at the end I checked the property records because in 2009, I got a statement from the government saying I owed this much in taxes. And so anyway, this whole process bankrupted me, and yes, I was homeless. Mm. It's been quite, and suicide, I considered it, but you know what? I thought, no, I am more than this, and I am not going to let my community members and my government let greed kill me. Wow. And so, but this is what it is. Every real estate agent that doesn't do their job, they contribute. Every mortgage agent, every home inspection company, and every homeowner who lies about the disclosure of the property, everyone did this. Mm. And the government supports it. So anyway, back to the, I forget the document that was filed. You go through your taxes where the mortgage company, because I bought the house for $550,000 and then it was sold for the land value only $350,000. So they considered made capital gains of $200,000. And I think that document, the government could turn around and reimburse me the money that they let the criminals steal. And they are criminals, and I don't understand why they are permitted to continue.
Thank you, Scush. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Linda. And I can't even imagine. Laura, how common is this story? I mean, you focused on these four specific families. And it's so difficult to just follow the paper trail. And you could hear, I mean, Linda's life was shattered by this.
This story is everywhere. You know, if we've had 10 million people evicted, how many tens of millions more people were not evicted or are still dealing with this? We have 3 million more home loans, so families, still going through the foreclosure pipeline. I want to reiterate one thing that Linda said, because I thought it was very perceptive, and that was this was caused by greed, that it was greed on lots of levels, sometimes on the local level, certainly on the Wall Street level, that this was a system of greed that incentivized people to lie, to falsify documents, to forge other people's names, and to take what they could get. And, you know, I'm going to say something that maybe some of the callers will disagree with, but when I hear an economic system based on greed, that we have had a problem with greed in this country, to me, I hear that we have a problem with an economic system of capitalism. And if we deregulate it, there's more greed. If we control it, there's less greed. Hmm. But at the end of the day, we live in an economic system in which we make money by being greedy, and we get by being greedy. And that's something that, honestly, I would like to see change.
Well, and I just want to briefly mention this editorial piece in the New York Times, because they pointed out that the Attorney General of Illinois, Lisa Madigan, just filed a lawsuit. This is the lawsuit accuses the largest property management company Safeguard in the industry of breaking into homes despite evidence of occupancy, damaging and removing personal property, changing locks, cutting off utilities, bullying occupants into leaving their home when they have the legal right to stay. And according to this piece, several private lawsuits have been filed because of this. How common is this practice?
I know one woman, one mother down in North Carolina who told me she sleeps with a baseball bat underneath her bed because she's in foreclosure and she doesn't know when somebody is going to come into her home and say they're a bank contractor and throw her and her stuff out of it. I've met sheriffs, particularly sheriffs down in the South, that say they've seen this happen all over their county, and yet they don't know. They're the law. They're the local law enforcement. They don't know who to hold accountable or how to hold accountable for this practice. So yes, I mean, from the individual house being foreclosed on, the way that is treated, all the way up to the securitization process in which millions upon millions of loans were churned through it, and everybody forgot that we were actually talking about families and houses in that process. This has been an illegal and immoral practice.
We have an email from Paul who says, please mention this wonderful government program that helps homeowners prevent foreclosure. It's called Keep Your Home California. According to the site, 18 states, including California, have been designated as hardest hit. And it says California has $2 billion in funds to help eligible homeowners keep their homes. What are your thoughts on these programs?
When the programs work, they do good work. I have seen a mixed track record with hardest hit fund. I know that in Michigan, for example, the money was not allocated quickly, and now much of the hardest hit fund, or at least portion of it, is actually being used to tear down vacant properties where the family was already forced out through a bank-pursued foreclosure. So my question is, why didn't that money just reach that family sooner so that they could still be in that house rather than tearing it down? I'm certainly not here to slam government programs. I want the government to be more involved in this, but I do have to say really clearly from my, you know, months upon months of driving around the country and speaking to people going through this issue, what they have overwhelmingly told me is that it's community groups, local activist groups, church groups, and community-based organizations that are really the ones on the front lines keeping people in their homes and helping people who are homeless move into homes.
Well, we've got one more caller who wants to talk to you about what's going on in Richmond, California. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. We're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, Rose. Thanks for having this. In Richmond, they're attempting to use eminent domain for the people. And one of the things that hasn't been mentioned is how much the banks and the real estate industry are holding on to places where they've had upticks in the cost of housing so that they can they can profit yet again. So if you could tell people about what Richmond's doing.
Thank you for bringing that up. I'm really excited by what Richmond is doing, because it is what, in my mind, eminent domain is supposed to do. And so what Richmond is doing and what the mayor there has proposed and is moving forward with is using eminent domain, first offering banks to write down the principal, so to do principal reduction for homeowners who are underwater or have even defaulted already on their mortgages. And then if the banks will not do so, the mayor has proposed to use eminent domain to seize those loans and then write down the principals, because then they would be controlled by the local city government, and then you sell a reduced version of that loan back to the family at a price that they can pay, and it also at a price that reflects the current market rate of those houses. It's a very exciting proposal, not only because it really does have the possibility of keeping people in their homes, but also because it shows once again that on the local level, local officials and community groups are really coming out to support their own community. It's at the federal level that we cannot see meaningful action, and we have not seen it. And right now, given what the government is going through in these shenanigans, I'm not very hopeful that we're going to see that either.
We've got 30 seconds. Do you think that the plan we're seeing in Richmond might spread across the country?
I know that there's dozens of cities that are looking to Richmond and want to do it too. The main problem, I'll say it again, is that not just the banks, but also the federal government has come out very aggressively in opposition of that plan, and that's atrocious.
The Obama administration specifically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Laura Gottesdiener is a journalist and activist. Her latest book, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. She found that 10 million people have lost their homes in the past 6 years. The website we mentioned is keepyourhomecalifornia.org. Laura, thank you so much for the research you've done, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How is restorative justice affecting troubled students? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about these programs in schools. Last year in Oakland, where the majority of suspensions were African-American students, the school district turned to restorative justice as a way to resolve conflict and decrease suspensions. So how are these programs being used to teach kids alternatives to conflict and help keep them out of the prison system and in school? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Hannah Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Work with Marty Nemko, my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, and I are going to discuss Sheryl Sandberg's best-selling book, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. Plus, you can call in for a 3-minute workover on Work with Marty Nemko, Sunday at 11. That's Sundays from 11 to noon here on 91.7, your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
Hello, welcome to the BBC News programme where you help us report and discuss what's happening. I'm Ben James. This is World Have Your Say.
One faction of one party in one House of Congress, in one branch of government, doesn't get to shut down the entire government just to refight the results of an election.
What does the US government shutdown say about politics in America? The two houses of Congress failed to agree a new budget, so a partial shutdown of the functions of government has begun for the first time in 17 years. Does this show off the checks and balances which protect US democracy? Or does it show a dysfunctional system struggling to cope? With your help, we'll explain what the shutdown means and hear a group of Americans discuss how it reflects on their country. You can tweet with the hashtag WHYS to ask them a question.
BBC News with David Austin. President Obama has again urged Republicans in the House of Representatives to allow the government to reopen and fulfill its duties. In a news conference, Mr. Obama was harshly critical of the party.
Republicans in the House of Representatives refused to fund the government unless we defunded or dismantled the Affordable Care Act. They've shut down the government over an ideological crusade to deny affordable health insurance to millions of Americans.
More than 700,000 federal workers are facing uncertainty with their jobs closed until agreement on a government funding bill is reached. Earlier, the Senate again rejected a budget proposal from the House of Representatives, which included an amendment delaying Mr. Obama's health care reforms, parts of which were due to come into effect today. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has used his speech to the UN General Assembly to warn against working with the Iranian government. He insisted Tehran still wanted to destroy Israel, despite comments by its new president, Hassan Rouhani.
Rouhani doesn't sound like Ahmadinejad, but when it comes to Iran's nuclear weapons program, the only difference between them is this. Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing. Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing. A wolf who thinks he can pull the wool over the eyes of the international community.
Despite a recent thaw in relations between the US and Iran, President Obama told Mr. Netanyahu yesterday that the use of force was still on the table in dealing with Tehran's nuclear program. A team of international disarmament experts has arrived in Damascus to begin dismantling Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. The Syrian government has said it will comply with their work. Their arrival came as Human Rights Watch issued a statement raising concerns about the use of conventional weapons against civilians in Syria, which detailed a deadly airstrike by the army on a school 2 days ago. The organization says that video evidence indicates the use of highly indiscriminate fuel air explosives, known as vacuum bombs, in that attack. The European share market has rebounded as investors bet on the Italian government surviving a confidence vote on Wednesday. The change follows signs that former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's attempt to bring down the government is foundering. This report by our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
Investors in the financial markets see Italy's economic prospects as intimately linked to the political situation. They're more willing to buy Italian financial assets if there's a government willing and able to make reforms. Silvio Berlusconi wanted his People of Freedom Party to withdraw its support from the current administration. But there are now reports that some of the party's senators will not do so, meaning there's a better chance of the government surviving and at least trying to press ahead with its reforms. That development received an enthusiastic welcome in the Milan stock market.
World News from the BBC. A panel of historians is calling on the French government to rewrite the military records of hundreds of First World War soldiers who were shot for cowardice and desertion. Christian Fraser reports from Paris.
In the mud and the futility of it all, there were many who cracked. Hundreds were shot for insubordination and disgraced through time as cowards. But now a group of prominent researchers and historians on the First World War list names of 650 men executed by the French who, in the view of the experts, deserve recognition. They've asked the Veterans Minister to recognise within the commemorations that many of those who were executed were shot in rushed, sometimes arbitrary conditions.
The United Nations has called on Spain to overturn a law that pardons crimes committed during the dictatorship of General Franco, who died in 1975. Hundreds of thousands of people disappeared during the Spanish Civil War and the 36 years of fascist rule that followed. But the killings remain unsolved because of an amnesty passed shortly after Franco's death. UN investigators accuse Spain's politicians from right and left of drawing a veil over history. A court in Ecuador has begun hearing the country's first ever trial of alleged crimes against humanity. Prosecutors have accused 10 police and army officers of torture, sexual violence and the abduction of three suspected members of an illegal opposition group in 1985. One of the victims was kept in captivity for nearly 3 years. The US space agency NASA says it's detected a chemical used to make plastic on one of Saturn's moons. It's the first time that the chemical, propylene, which is used on Earth to make household containers and car bumpers, has been detected on another world. The agency says its Cassini probe identified a small amount of propylene in Titan's lower atmosphere. It's known to contain a significant number of different chemicals, including hydrocarbons. And those are the latest stories from BBC News.
This is Lise Doucette from BBC News. You're listening to World Have Your Say.
Hello there, welcome. It's lunchtime in Washington, D.C., and more than 13 hours since the deadline passed for the two houses of the U.S. Congress to agree on a budget. They didn't, so as September turned into October, the partial shutdown of the U.S. federal government began. I can see countdown clocks on U.S. TV networks counting the hours and minutes of the shutdown so far. We'll talk about what it actually means and how much it matters outside Washington. We'll hear from Seattle, Cleveland, Miami and Phoenix over the next hour. I can see your comments and questions too from Zambia, India and Uganda. What does the government shutdown say about politics in America? Mabu in Port Harcourt, Nigeria tweets, the US shutdown's a sign of a healthy democracy where issues are discussed without fist fighting. Well, if you're listening in the US, we'll find out if you agree. I'm Ben James. You can ask your questions on Twitter as well. Use the hashtag WHYS.
Tweet us using the hashtag
WHYS.
And in the last few minutes, while you were hearing the BBC News Bulletin, President Obama's been speaking in the garden at the White House. Let's hear what he had to say.
At midnight last night, can everybody hear me? Mic working? Good morning, everybody. At midnight last night, for the first time in 17 years, the Republicans in Congress chose to shut down the federal government. Let me be more specific. One faction of one party in one House of Congress, in one branch of government, shut down major parts of the government, all because they didn't like one law. This Republican shutdown did not have to happen, but I want every American to understand why it did happen. Republicans in the House of Representatives refused to fund the government unless we defunded or dismantled the Affordable Care Act. They've shut down the government over an ideological crusade to deny affordable health insurance to millions of Americans. In other words, they demanded ransom just for doing their job. And many representatives, including an increasing number of Republicans, have made it clear that had they been allowed by Speaker Boehner to take a simple up or down vote on keeping the government open, with no partisan strings attached, enough votes from both parties would have kept the American people's government open and operating. Now, we may not know the full impact of this Republican shutdown for some time. It will depend on how long it lasts. But we do know a couple of things. We know that the last time Republicans shut down the government in 1996, it hurt our economy. And unlike 1996, our economy is still recovering from the worst recession in generations. We know that certain services and benefits that America's seniors...
That's President Obama speaking a few minutes ago in the garden at the White House. And just down the road from him, Mark Bloomfield sitting listening to him in our BBC Washington studio, an economist, president of the American Council for Capital Formation. Hi, Mark. Welcome to World Have Your Say.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be on the show.
And Rebecca Cinderbrand's with us as well, the Deputy White House Editor for Politico. Hi there, Rebecca. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And maybe I can start with you. We heard President Obama's version of why this has happened. What are the Republicans' version of what happened?
Well, you know, the Republicans are saying what they've been saying all along, that in their version of events, it's the White House's fault that the government is shut down because of its insistence on funding Obamacare. Of course, that leaves out a lot of pieces, including the fact that the Senate is solidly behind the president. But they're very much framing this as the White House has embraced Obamacare, the White House is insisting on Obamacare, and that's why the government has shut down.
We need to do a bit of a shutdown dictionary here, Mark and Rebecca. We've got lots of words flying around here that are very specific to this situation, so hopefully you can help me briefly with them. Mark, what is a shutdown exactly?
A shutdown means that there is no more money for the government to operate. Under our Constitution, the Congress every year gives the executive branch money to operate, and that ran out of money to operate the government on October 1.
Rebecca?
And, you know, one of the things we kind of have to point out, and one of the reasons the president has been drawing such a hard line here, is that what the government was operating under is something, not to get too technical, called the continuing resolution. So this isn't even the budget for the next year we're talking about. This is just a budget that was supposed to get the government through the next few weeks. There's another fight coming up in just a couple of weeks, the same thing all over again over the next budget. And there's also another fight coming up in just about 2 weeks now over the debt ceiling, which is another issue entirely. All three of those involve actions that the president has said Congress has to take, not as a matter of negotiation, but as part of their responsibility.
Another word for the shutdown dictionary that I've seen flying around a lot is furlough. Mark, what does that mean? That's something to do with the workers that will no longer be able to work.
Yes, because there is no money, as Rebecca said, for funding the government right now. There are 800,000, I think, government employees, because there's no money to pay them, who have to take a forced holiday. The ones that are needed to run the government have to work without pay. And the others just are told to stay home and not collect their salary.
And there are a few, just a handful, military members of the active duty military, for example, who will be paid. A special last-minute bill signed by the president last night, sent to him by Congress, will ensure that active duty members of the military serving in harm's way will get their pay. But there are many Defense Department civilian employees who won't.
And Isaac listens to us in Nairobi, Kenya, posting on our Facebook page, wants to know, does this mean that all government institutions will be closed? Mark?
No. You will still, people on Social Security will still get their checks. As Rebecca pointed out, the military is still going to be working. The sort of examples of things that are going to be closed down are like the national parks. There's a big sign if you go to Yosemite that says you can't, the park is shut down because of the what Congress did and didn't appropriate money. So a lot of the essential government services will be provided. Some will not be provided, and some will be in a situation where necessary workers are show up and unnecessary workers are told to go home.
And you talk about the various cultural institutions. The zoo as well has come up quite a lot. The panda camp, a lot of people are talking about, as one example of something that will cease to function, a webcam showing the pandas in that zoo. But I'm told the animals will still be fed, Rebecca.
That's right. You know, there's others also that, you know, very lots of symbolism involved. The same thing that happened during the last shutdown, you know, the Statue of Liberty, national parks. Right now, you know, the Google homepage here in the U.S. is celebrating national parks, the anniversary of one of our biggest national parks. National parks are shut down. People can't visit those. And so even though we're talking about, in some cases, symbolism, there's still a lot of it grabs the public's attention. Something that's getting a lot of attention in Washington right now is a group of World War II veterans who came to visit the memorial and just, you know, were told it was shut down and decided to go visit it anyway. And so the kind of the symbolism of that is grabbing a lot of attention.
Well, let's hear from elsewhere now. We've heard from Washington, D.C., where you guys both are, and that's where this conversation is centered. But what does it mean to people around the rest of the U.S.? Let's speak to Chris, who's in Seattle, to Nancy, who's in Virginia, and Skip, who is back with us on World Have Your Say from Jones Turkey Farm in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there, Skip. Welcome back. Hi to Nancy and Chris as well.
How are you? Thank you.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Skip, what does this mean where you are?
Well, I don't know what it's going to mean to the individual around here, but what is the non-essential worker? But we're going to keep the people who keep the government running. I'd like to know that. If they're non-essential, are they supposed to be there? What do they do? That's either here or there. His speech was absolutely pathetic. A handful of Republicans shut this entire country down? Give me a break. They're both of them got, they're into it up to their waist, both of them. Both parties, doesn't matter. All they're doing is chest bumping, and we're going to see who can bump who out of the way. It's just disgusting. It really is.
Chris in Seattle, how'd it look to you?
If he can exempt companies from the Health Care Act, which he has, he's exempted unions, companies, or maybe we should insert the word contributors, why can't he postpone some of this stuff for a year?
Okay, well, we'll get into some of that depth on that to explain to people a bit later. Chris in Seattle, how does it look to you?
Oh, well, being one of those non-essential employees here, I can tell Skip exactly what I do. I do policy analysis for the government, and I'm not at work today, despite the fact that I do have deadlines that will have to be met. Those will just have to be postponed.
So have you not gone in at all, Chris? Just explain that to us. You what, 10 in the morning, something like that, in Seattle at the moment? Take us through your
10
day.
10 in the morning. I did go in earlier today to do my shutdown duties. I secured my office. I changed my outgoing voicemail message to say that I will not be answering calls. For me to do any work is actually a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act, so I am not allowed to do any work whatsoever.
And so without that work, what could the consequences be?
Oh, I don't get paid. And I'm just waiting like the other 700,000 or 800,000 federal employees. I'm just waiting for the call to go back to work.
Will you not get paid, Chris, or will it be a delayed pay?
Right now, there's nothing official, but generally, when this happened 17 years ago, we were restored pay after a bit, so yeah, I may see it down the line.
That's another one of my points. It's always, I remember Bill Clinton back 17 years ago standing there in front of cameras. The people aren't going to have enough money for a turkey for Thanksgiving, blah, 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 and everybody got paid. It's going to, everything will be fine. We're going to do this chest bumping for a couple, 3 weeks.
This chest bumping didn't need to happen. And it's really pathetic. It's very petty. And it's, I'm afraid I do have to agree that it's a small portion of individuals that the speaker agreed to say, no, we're not going to do this budget portion, despite the fact that the Affordable Care Act from the beginning was passed through legitimate legislation, and that even after that, the president was reelected, and even Senator McCain, who has never supported the Affordable Care Act, said on the Senate floor that this is not the proper way to run the government. That really, if the Republicans want to change this law or repeal it or alter it or whatever they want to do, they need to win elections. They need to control both chambers and have a veto-proof majority or occupy the White House as well.
Let's bring in Nancy, who's listening to both of you.
That's
not gonna happen. Let's bring in Nancy.
Both chambers and have a veto-proof majority or occupy the White House.